All right, everybody, you know how much I love TrueCar because it's changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save, get this, an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then, register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step, very simple. Just print out your savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com. Hey, everybody, welcome to the podcast. This week, I have Larry the Cable Guy, Dan Whitney, a.k.a. Larry the Cable Guy, and a really cool conversation with Dan about how he started out in comedy and came up with the character of Larry the Cable Guy. And I really, really want you to pay close attention to how hard this guy worked and, you know, what went into the idea of the character, and that there's more than meets the eye there. You know, it's not just a guy telling fart jokes, but sort of somebody who really sort of put some thought into kind of creating a character that speaks to a certain kind of person in our culture. And just a really interesting conversation across the board, and of course very funny. Dan's a really funny guy, and so check it out, and check me out doing stand-up. For tour dates, go to my website, paulmercurio.com, and follow me on Facebook and Twitter, folks, and spread the word, especially get the word out on this one. I'm really excited about the podcast, and it's been blowing up. We've had some really great guests on recently, and want to keep the train moving here. So thanks for checking it out, and send the podcast around and keep tuning in. Thanks, people. All right, welcome to the podcast this week. Very, very, very funny man and a good friend, Larry the Cable Guy. I can't believe you're on my show. Awesome. Thanks, buddy. How you doing?
Well, very good, Evo. I figured I gave you the just waking up.
Just waking up?
Cable Guy.
Are you
What's going on, pal? Doing good, man. Doing good. Just sitting here waiting on you to call us, and you fix all your gadgets and your buttons and all that kind of stuff. See, I got these podcasts ready. You just get on the phone. You got an hour to kill, but holy mackerel, you're going through all kinds. You got 37 producers.
We do. We have a link, a satellite link that goes up to Mars that bounces off of that, and it... It goes through a guy in Australia, and I got one of those Tandy computers from Radio Shack. That's how it all comes together.
Dude, you got the Tandy 2000.
I got the Tandy 2000. You say, hey, by the way, before I forget, when I mean this as a compliment, when I have to burp, fart, or shit, I think of you because of those Prilosec commercials. Nice job on those, buddy.
Well, that's what I was going for. That's exactly what I was going for. You know, it's crazy. You do all this stuff, and then you get a Prilosec commercial, and that gives you more press than anything else. I mean, they got cardboard cutouts and Walgreens and Targets and Walmarts and your picture and People magazine every week. I mean, that thing has been awesome.
Yeah, it's great, man. And you're on that. And every time I'm watching TV and I'm with my son Alex, I'm like, "That's my friend. I know that guy. That's really cool." Are you kidding? Come on, that's like the kind of thing.
Those are fun to do. They've been real good to me, and I like doing them. I mean, you get to go do a lot of real cool things. And
how do you shoot?
It's really cool when you're like walking around when you're like, I just did the American Century Tournament again for the second year in a row, and so you know, you walk around and Joe Pye's been walking by. What's going on, Prilosec?
Is that what he said?
It's kind of funny, you know.
And he's got that pill for like bad urine flow. So like,
yeah, exactly. So we're a perfect pair.
Yeah.
Everybody out there's promoting bad urine flow. I got heartburn. A couple other people out there.
When you shoot with the Prilosec stuff, like, do you shoot a block of them at one time? Like, how do people let people understand like how that stuff is done? Like, are you like? Like you did the one like on a jet ski, right? And then they like you're there all day at a lake doing that, or how does that?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. You just go out there and you're pretty much there all day on a lake. And I like doing commercials because they're fun because you shoot everything in segments. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like I take Prilosec OTC for my frequent heartburn. So that'll just be, you know, they'll have a cue card for you, but after you do it like 7 times. Mm. So, okay, walk towards the jet ski. Okay, ready, action. I take Prilosec OTC every morning for my frequent heartburn. Okay, let's do it again. You know, and that's pretty much it. Then they take the best one out of the 7, and then you go to another scene, and then there's 8 lines, and you do those 8 lines. And, I mean, it's look, commercial work is awesome if you get it. So I enjoy
it. Great. So there's an interesting, I was kind of, I mean, I know you, but I was just kind of reading up on you a little bit, and kind of a little birdie told me that, you know, you grew up in Pawnee, Nebraska, like cow and pig country and all that.
Yeah,
and that
Pawnee City. You can't just call them Pawnee because Pawnee City, that's what we're proud of there. Pawnee City is the only Pawnee city in the United States. The Pawnee, there's a lot of Pawnees, but there's only one Pawnee City.
Wait, what is Pawnee, what do you mean, Pawnee, like the Indian Pawnee?
Yeah, they're named after the Indians, the Pawnee Indians, but we're the only ones, like there's Pawnee, Oklahoma, there's Pawnee, Texas, but there's no Pawnee City, Oklahoma, there's no Pawnee City, Texas, there's only one Pawnee City, and that's Pawnee City.
And your dad was a minister, right? And
yeah, he was. My dad did a lot of stuff. My dad had a crazy childhood. My dad played with the Everly Brothers when he was 18, went and got saved in a foxhole when he was in Korea, and came back, wanted to preach. And so he was a preacher on the weekends, a guidance counselor at a public school on the weekdays. He farmed and did farm work on Saturdays, afternoons, and he, in his days off, and then he also, what else did he do? He played in a band. He had a band called the Memphis Beats, so he played in a band on the weekends.
Oh, my God.
Many a time when I was a little kid, I'd go with him sometimes, and I'd be sitting at the table there at the VFW Club, and some deacon had come up from the church, and he hammered, Preacher, can you play some Merle Haggard? We'll get that on for you. And it was just, I mean, it was crazy.
And he'd play it?
Oh, heck yeah. My dad sounded, and call me crazy, but my dad sounded exactly like Elvis Presley. You can't tell the difference. Matter of fact, I was listening to an Elvis live CD the other day, and my mom popped over to see the kids, and Elvis just started singing Proud Mary. It's a live version, so it's, you know, a rough live version. And she literally goes, hey, where'd you get that tape of your dad? And I go, what are you talking about? She goes, where'd you get that tape of your dad singing? And I go, Mom, I go, that's Elvis. Oh my gosh, I had just forgotten how much they sound alike.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, so he was really talented. So he did a ton of stuff.
Was that his sort of first love? Like, if he could have done that as a career,
yeah,
did he want
to do that? He actually had a letter my mom's got in her hope chest from Roy Acuff back in the 50s, basically saying that he's glad that he'd found religion, but he truly believed if he'd have stayed and came to Nashville, he'd have been the next big thing.
Wow.
But yeah, but so it was, yeah, it was really, yeah, he was really talented.
Go ahead.
He wasn't really, he was funny when he wanted to be. He was way more serious than he was funny, but when he wanted to be funny, he was.
Yeah, and was he funny, like, would he do, like, just jokes around the house or pranks or, like, goof around?
He didn't do a lot of jokes around the house. My dad was a very serious guy, you know, he was a preacher and very strict and, you know, pretty hard on you. know. But I mean, I loved him to death. But he was just, he was really strict. You know, he was a lot easier on me than he was my brother. But he was just real strict. So you know, it's one of those things where everybody loved to talk to him. Boy, your dad, I just love talking to him. Well, you don't live with him. One of those things. You know?
It's the same thing about my mother. She's 87. She runs a furniture store in Rhode Island where we grew up, and she'd say, oh, your mother's such a hoot. She's so cute. And I'm like, yeah, try living with her for 2 days. You want to kill her. You want to kill her. My mother wears a hearing aid, which she found in the garbage because she doesn't want to buy anything because she grew up in the Depression, and it whistles all the time. So she can't hear anybody. It's always like, it's like one of those things. And she's very forgetful, so she locks customers in her store. She forgets people are there. And she has to run an errand, and she locks customers in the store, and then we have to get them out, like shit like that. And you're like, oh, she's so adorable. Like, yeah, try living with this Italian Tasmanian devil.
We would say the same thing. My dad, we'd have devotions at night or something, and they'd last 2 hours. People say, your dad is so knowledgeable about the Bible and theology, and I just love to, I bet you learned so much from him. Yeah, I learned to avoid him. That's what I've learned how to do.
Just so people know, Larry the Cable Guy is a character you came up with. Your Dan Whitney is your God-given name, and you started out as a comedian as Dan Whitney, which I want to talk about in a minute. But were you like a handful growing up? Were you a ball buster? Were you like a...
No, you know what? Not at all. I kind of did my own thing. I was... we grew up next to... We had, you know, livestock. I grew up raising pigs. I grew up next to a livestock barn. My dad was gone all the time. He was always doing something, so I didn't see him a lot. I saw him... on Sundays, and I saw him when I had to work out and make fence and stuff on Saturday afternoons. But for the most part, the guy that ran the sale barn, his name was Kenny Klepper. He was my adopted grandpa, really. He took me around and did everything with me. And I lived my whole first 15 and a half years of my life. I moved away when I was 15 and a half from Nebraska. So I spent, from the time I was probably 6 years old till 15 and a half, I spent every day over there loading cattle trucks and hanging out with auctioneers and
You know, it's funny because our mutual friend Colleen Quinn, who owns the Omaha Funny Bone, who is a dear, sweet person, and a place where I think it's fair to say you got your start or really kind of came into your own. And it's a great club. If anybody is near Omaha and needs to go see anybody at the Omaha Funny Bone,
it's one of the, it was one of the best clubs that I ever worked at. You know, I came out of the Comedy Corner in West Palm Beach, Florida, and at the time, you know, Rolling Stone magazine had it as one of the top five comedy clubs in the country. The one where I came out of in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Yeah.
But I would probably put Omaha Funny Bone and the Columbus Funny Bone. Those two clubs were smoking hot, and I mean, just great crowd. So yeah, she ran a great club. Been around forever too.
Yeah, and she still does. She's really great. And she was telling me a little bit that you would go to auctions for cattle auctions and pig auctions and stuff, and that was sort of something you thought about you would do as an adult, would be an auctioneer, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to do when I was growing up. I wanted to be a cattle auctioneer. And, of course, then I moved away, so I got away from that culture for a while.
So you're in West Palm Beach, Florida, and there weren't a lot of cattle to auction on West Palm Beach.
But you know what? All the girls in my class made up for it. You know, I had 16 girls in my class in Nebraska, and moved to Florida, and I had about 160. So that was like going, and I had a convenience store down the road. You mean to tell me you can actually go to a convenience store and buy a soda pop in the middle of the night? I mean, that's unheard of. I never heard of such a thing. So you mean to tell me there's actually more than 16 girls to pick from that live in this city? Are you kidding me? I mean, so it was definitely a lifestyle change. I hated it the first year, and then I got in the swing of things, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, you went there because your dad moved there for his ministry, right? He relocated for his job?
He actually got a job as the elementary principal at a Christian school down there. So that's why we moved down there.
And so did you ever try, can you do like the auctioneer thing? Do you know, if you have the can you do that whole thing with the, like...
I'm gonna put my hand up.
Did you just say something or have like a mild stroke? What was that?
I started it, we've been at 2.5 now, Woody bed now, give me 2.5 now, bed now, 5, 2.5, Woody bed now, 5.
You just said those words? Those are actual words you said?
Yeah, but you can't hear them because they're going so doggone fast.
Oh.
I used to be better at it than I am now. You know, when I do celebrity auctions and stuff, I'll always go, so I'll be selling something, and I'll get up there, and I'll do the whole, what do you give, 4.5, what about a hand, I would have been now high, even would have been now high, too bad, I had that, I would have been now high, I had that, too. And then I start going like, people start. I did that for my show Only in America. I was so nervous. They wanted me to. I was at a cattle auction, so I was doing the whole thing. So we taped it, and I auctioned off 3 cows. First time ever down here in Oklahoma. I sit in the booth, and there's, you know, those auctions, only probably 18 farmers in there.
Yeah.
I start going into the, what do you, 4.5? And this dude is about 80 years old. I thought he was going to piss his pants. I mean, he was bent over laughing. Oh, my gosh. That was fun, though. Believe it or not, that was one of my thrills of my life.
You know what? I think everything.
A lot of people, Paul, want to play Carnegie Hall. I was excited to auction a cow off in Oklahoma.
This is a man who, like, who fulfilled 2 dreams in his life. He auctioned the cow in Oklahoma, and he was able to get soda pop at 2:00 in the morning at a 7-Eleven.
It was a whole different world, I'll tell you what, when I moved to Florida. But I'm glad I did. But you know,
well, that's kind of where it. That's where you started doing your stand up, right? When you were in high school, and you kind of, I guess,
started doing stand up. I came home from college,
mm-hmm.
and I played baseball, so I actually set out. The winter half, fall half of college, when I went to college, because I wanted to make money so when the spring came I could play baseball and not worry about having to work. I could pay my way through school for the second half.
Right.
And, I had no clue what I wanted to do. I just went to the college because everybody else went to college where we were going. I went to a Baptist college in Georgia, and I went there because that's where my buddies were going. And I wanted to play baseball. I didn't really, you know, I was a kid. I was 18, 19 years old. I was just having fun. And so I started working at the Hyatt Regency as a bellhop, and I was making money hand over fist. And I actually got coaxed into getting up. People thought I was funny. And so one of my best buddies, they got me to go up on stage at an open mic night at a bar sponsored by a radio station.
Nice.
And that's when I went on stage for the first time, and that's when I got hooked on doing stand-up.
Oh, really?
And
did you did you have some jokes like written already, or what kind of stuff were you doing at the time?
Man, I had no clue what I was doing. I think I probably went up and did 2 Leno jokes in a Seinfeld. I mean, I had no clue anything about it. I remember I went up with a buckwheat cutoff. I had a cutoff shirt on. I had a buckwheat because I always wore, for some reason, when I lived in Florida, I just started going to T-shirts and cutoff shirts because it was so hot.
Yeah.
I wore a David Lee Roth type hat, and I went up with a boombox with a tape in it with my own applause, because I was always a goofy. I've always been a fan of the goofy vaudevillish type entertainment.
Well, you say that Steve Martin and Monty Python big influences on you.
I love those guys. I mean, love them. So I went on stage and I had a cigar. I had a copy of the Weekly World News. I think I would read a headline, I'd comment on the headline, I'd do some stupid fart noise, and then I'd hit the button and the applause would come on. I'm not kidding. I had I didn't have a rim shot, but I had some kind of a thing I blew in that went whee, that made a whistle. So I would tell a joke, and it was kind of a mix between, I don't know, just a hyper idiot with Charlie Callis type fart sound.
Oh, I love Charlie Callis.
Before I go on with this, let me just say this about Charlie Callis, and don't forget where I'm at, but Charlie Callis I met in Vegas. I put him in my Christmas special. I became really good friends with Charlie Callis. I love that guy to death. He did 2 of my Christmas specials, and he couldn't make the last one because his legs were really bad, and he just couldn't travel, but sent me a card. But he told me, sitting in a wheelchair, my second Christmas special in Nashville, and he goes, "Larry, I just want to tell you, I just want to... and he was trying. He was trying to tell me something nice, but he can't. He's got to do his stuff. And he goes, "I just wanted to say, I don't travel for anybody. Hello, I don't travel for anybody, but I love your comedy. I love how you I love how you still do the one-liners." And I told my wife, "I will do anything for this man, and I love you, and I thank you. I thank you for giving me the opportunity." And it was crazy, and he could barely walk. And what a performer. When it came time for him to come out on stage, I watched him from the side of the stage get out of that wheelchair, adjust his suit. The guy literally could barely walk, Paul. He got out of the wheelchair and walked like nothing was ever wrong with him, like a champ, to the middle of the stage, did his thing. He got a standing O. I could see his eyes kind of welling up, you know, with water. He was so happy. Turned around, walked like a champ, like nothing was wrong with him. As soon as he got out of sight, he bent over and he held his knees and he started rubbing them, and he sat in the wheelchair and he took his little napkin, he blew his nose and wiped his eyes, and I came off stage and he told me thank you again. And it was, and as he was walking, as they're pushing away in the wheelchair, he's going, "Boy, I'll tell you what, he was still doing it." And I gotta tell you, that guy's the funniest guy ever that I've ever met.
I love him. Every time you see him in something, he was in something where he's got a small scene in High Anxiety. Mel Brooks plays the psychiatrist in a psychiatric hospital. And he goes into like one of the psych ward where like they have to lock the people up in these rubber rooms. And one of the people is Charlie Callis, who thinks he's a dog, and he just is like being a dog for like 5 minutes. And the scene is like, if you look at it from like a script analysis, the scene has no connection to anything in the movie. It's just like, all right, we got to put Charlie in the movie. Let's just make him a dog in the thing. And he's just doing, and he's like peeing on stuff, and he's humping Harvey Korman's leg. And then he gets a couple of those in. Like, why would a dog be going, "Hurt"? Like, it didn't, like, it was hilarious.
He was the greatest with that stuff. But he, you know, in my first Christmas special, I saw them with Charlie Callis down there in the theater, and he had a line to say. And it was a big holdup. So I go to the director, who didn't get Charlie Callis. He didn't understand Charlie Callis. I said, "What's going on? How come this is taking so long?" "Well, Charlie can't see the teleprompter. He's not getting his lines right. He's freaking out because he doesn't think he." And I said, "Okay, you guys, seriously." I go, "Hey, Charlie." I go, "All you have to say, you don't need a teleprompter. Basically, all you have, the line is, how come there's no Jewish representation in the play?" Okay. "That's basically all I want you to say. But I want you to do it like you do it. And I don't care if it takes 5 minutes to do it. Just do it how you would do it."
Yeah.
And he goes, "Well, I can do that." I said, "Well, yeah, that's all you need to do." They had like a paragraph for him to say, and that's not what I wanted him to do. I wanted that. All he was supposed to do was ask, "Why isn't there any more Jewish representation?"
Right. You want Charlie Callis. You don't want him scripted. Yeah, exactly.
So that, sure enough, that night on VH1, Charlie stands up and goes, "Excuse me." I go, "Yes, sir." "I want to know. Hello. I want to know why there's no." I mean, he did the. Dude, people were dying laughing.
It just is like, he's the best. He's the best. Anybody that does not know Charlie Callis out there, go look him up. He's brilliant. He's brilliant. That's great that you kind of.
Anyway, I did, to make a long story longer, I did that's what I had, like a little sound effect machine, and I had that, and I didn't have any clue what I was doing. I would just read a headline from Weekly World News, comment on it, make a stupid sound, blow a buzzer, play my own applause. I mean, it was the craziest thing ever, but I was sure hooked on it after that. I liked it.
Hey, now, had your dad not been a performer, and I mean it in a broad sense, because in a way a minister is a preacher is a performer also, but you know, obviously he was a pure performer as a musician and a singer and all that. Do you think that that somehow bled into your psyche a little bit, like somehow you
I think it probably did everybody, because my sister and my brother were tremendous actors and actresses. I mean, they of course they did plays and stuff in college, but they went to the same college, and their professor came straight from Broadway. He was a guy that coached on Broadway, mm-hmm. and did stuff on Broadway, and I think directed a couple of plays. So he wasn't bad. He was good. He knew what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He said they were the best brother and sister team that he'd ever worked with. But they were really good, and they were hilarious. My brother is 10 times funnier than I am. He is just, he's very physical when he does jokes and stuff, and mm-hmm. and he doesn't think he's funny, which now you know he's funny, because you know,
yeah.
Normally, they don't think they're that funny, but
yeah,
but,
exactly.
So that ran in the family. My dad was hilarious when he wanted to be. He just didn't show that side a lot. My mom is a flipping riot. Yeah. So my mom and my brother, and my sister, we were all pretty funny. So
yeah. Did you? So, you know, you have what people need to understand is this character of Larry the Cable Guy, which, and I want to talk about this in a minute too. Kind of at some point, I think. Dan Whitney is Larry, and Larry is Dan, and morphs over time. And you've talked about that in an article that I was reading, but we'll get to that in a minute. But people need to understand, like, that this character was the result of a tremendous amount of hard work that came out of you. Just once you started being a stand-up full-time, like, you had this crazy work ethic of calling into radio stations around the country, and eventually kind of fell into this character that you were doing, which I think happened, if I'm told the story right, by Colleen, like, you were home for Thanksgiving, and you were on stage, and you were with Dan Whitney at the time, and you were doing very well as a comic, you know, and you had, like, khakis and a nice shirt, and you looked like a traditional stand-up comic, and we're doing some stuff on stage, and your cousin from the audience said something like, hey, do that thing that you were doing at Thanksgiving dinner, and then you put a hat on backwards, and you started doing sort of, like, this southern kind of accent.
Yeah, I went on stage at the Comedy Corner in West Palm Beach,
mm-hmm.
and I was, you know, it was an open mic night, so I was trying out some new stuff, and some was good, some was bad, mostly bad, and when I just said, hey, this guy ever come over your house, and it started out first as a rodeo guy, because I'm a rodeo fan,
mm-hmm.
put on a hat, and I was like, well, I bowled and took around there, took an ivory in him in the shorts, but we stayed on him for about 9 and a half, and that done took us to the pay window. So we hopefully next week, you know, and I just did the whole thing.
Did you say an ivory enema?
Yeah, the horns.
That's
that bull come around, you done give me an ivory enema, and I done stayed on him for 9 and a half. So he took me to the pay window, we had a good week this week and next week, you know. And it was okay.
Yeah.
And so the next day, I kind of tweaked it to, hey, this guy ever come over your house? And I was like, hey, do you order cable? And the reason I did it was the cable guy came out, and he made me laugh because he thought he had the wrong house, and, you know, the whole deal. And so I just started doing, they got a bigger laugh, and my buddy was on a morning show in Tampa, 95YNF, and they asked me if they said they needed characters.
This is the Ron and Ron show?
Yeah, Ron and Ron, yep. Yeah. And they, and at the time, back then, Bennington and I were really, really close friends, and Ronnie Diaz, and I still, to this day, I for some reason, he hates my guts now. I have no idea why, but...
Ron?
Yeah, and I have no idea why, but I still tell everybody that he's probably the funniest human being I've ever seen in my life. Ron and I had such a good time back in the day, then we just kind of grew apart and blah blah blah, but I tell everybody that he's got, I mean, I've never heard their show, but I mean, he's just a super, super funny guy. I've always thought he was like the most brilliant comic around, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. Went and did his radio show. I did character on there. I did a couple of characters for their show. And it just took off, you know, and they said, I said, it's the cable guy. Oh, yeah, remember, Ronnie, we had the cable guy. I went, what's your first name? I said, Larry. You know,
how did you come up with Larry?
From that point on, everybody knew me as Larry the Cable Guy, and I never did any appearances. I would never do appearances because it was a character that I created. I wanted to create. I kind of went by the Howard Stern mode of radio: be shocking first and foremost, be funny, then be shocking. You have to say something to keep the hold the audience. Well, I can't believe you just said that.
Right.
And then while they're listening, now you're soup, and then that'd be funny. Right. You know? And then I kind of wanted to make a little point, if there was any point to be made.
Yeah, political thing or something, a commentary,
yeah.
Social commentary.
But what I wanted to create was, I was a big fan of All in the Family. I mean, we can't do shows like that anymore because we're so effing politically correct about anything. You can't do anything anymore because everybody is a four-year-old little pussy and they can't handle any kind of humor.
Yeah, and so, you can say fuck on here if you want, by the way.
Okay, so we'll never have... okay, perfect. So we'll never have any good shows like that anymore. So
exactly.
Good creative shows like All in the Family and the Jeffersons, we'll never have those anymore. Every show now that we have that everybody thinks is funny, all the funny jokes are dick jokes. They're all subtle dick jokes.
Right, and the problem is that what they do is they couch it like, this is edgy and cool, but it's a dick joke. And if you don't get it, then you're not edgy and cool. But you know what? A shitty dick joke is a shitty dick joke. You know what I mean? Like, there's better ways to do this stuff that's smarter.
Well, exactly. But PC has pretty much killed good sitcoms. So, but anyway, I wanted to create... I loved Archie's humor. I thought he was hilarious, you know. But he was a dick. I mean, let's face it. Archie there was tender moments with him that you could see the inside of Archie, but then he's just a dick to everybody. So I wanted to create something like Archie as far as the political views, but I wanted it to be likable. I wanted people to go, just Larry, he doesn't mean nothing by it. He's just beer-drinking kind of fun guy, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what I tried to create, and I think that's what came across. I mean...
So hang on a second. Because I'm fascinated by this as a a comic who writes for himself and writes for other people and blah, 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 and you're always thinking about your character and... It's funny because I'm doing some other newer kind of material that's a little different than what I've been doing. You know, you're always morphing and whatever. But how did you figure out? Because that's the hard thing, is to be true to this sort of un-PC, sort of not politically correct kind of character that you want to do, but at the same time not lose the audience and pander to them. So how did you figure out how to do that? What was the hook or the thing that you figured out that would allow you to have both things?
Well, you know, when I started doing it, I pushed it on radio and went around. People asked me what I did, and I pushed it on radio. But I think I just kind of, when I went on stage and did these jokes, they were funny. They made me laugh. It was an escape for me because it was things that. The radio was completely different than my stage act because it was a complete radio character. I made up girlfriends. I made up ex-wives.
Mm-hmm.
I made up because, you know, you could do that. It was theater of the mind. Radio was theater of the mind.
Right.
Then when I started doing it on stage in 95, the reason I started doing it on stage was my buddy Les McCurdy billed me as AKA Larry the Cable Guy.
I know Les McCurdy. I know him down there in Sarasota.
Yeah, he's a great guy. So he billed me as Larry the Cable Guy. And it sold a ton of tickets, and people started yelling, do Larry. So I came out of, I went into character. I couldn't follow it. I went out of character. I couldn't
follow
it.
Right, so just so people understand what we're talking about, you're still going out as, you're going on these shows as Dan Whitney, these radio shows, but going into different characters. You had Larry the Kid. What were some of the other characters you were doing in addition
to? Oh, man, I did Larry the Cable Guy. I did Iris, an old Jewish woman from Boca Raton.
Wait, so you do, dude, do you mind? Just, I got to hear you do that. Can you do her?
I did, back when I did Ron and Ron, let's see, I used to go like, hello, Ron, this is Ivy. You know, my father, he's not a laugher, and I'll tell you, you just make us laugh. We just laugh and laugh. You know, so I did that. He ran, he was on medication, and he ran into the public supermarket yesterday with his car. You know, so I did that. That was actually probably more popular than Larry when I started doing that. I think that's the first one I did.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I did everything, you know, assorted gay characters. And, yeah. You know, any kind of character you could think. But, you know, people go, well, how could you? It was a different world, man. Back in radio, back in the 80s and 90s, you could do anything you wanted.
Yeah, you know, Colleen Quinn and I were talking about that, like, because I said to her, I said, do you think Dan could... A person today could sort of do what Dan did, which is sort of go on like a bunch of radio shows like for 13 years on a regular basis and build characters like that. And she goes, I don't think so for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a much more PC world that we live in. And secondly, radio's changed and there's not just as many spots to go on because they want to play music because they got all this research and all that other stuff. It's just, they're just harder and it's a harder time to do it. And like, but you're right. I mean, like the kind of stuff that you're talking about. And to have that freedom to do that was like, but were you doing characters as Dan Whitney in your act too, or were you just doing straight stand-up in your act?
Oh, no, I did. My act was crazy. My act was one-liners, physical, just a lot of ad-libbing. It was nuts. So Dom Herrera, Dom's a buddy of mine. So
yeah, me too. I love Dom.
If you ever talk to Dom, ask Dom Herrera. Dom Herrera used to say, I had the best, fastest, first 10 minutes of comedy. And he would always say, he goes, dude, if you're ever at an open mic night and you got to follow Dan Whitney, don't do it, because he literally has the, that's how I got the name Freight Train of Comedy, because I would just boom, 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 boom. Hey, what's going on? Good to see you. You know,
You would literally do all that stuff, like, and not just one line.
And then
like,
he goes, but Dom Herrera goes, ah, hey, what's this, Dan Whitney? He's got the best 10 minutes, 12 minutes of comedy. After that,
I worked with Dom before, and he's got this one joke that I love. I don't know why, just so much, but he's so funny. And he goes, yeah, you know, he's this Italian guy from Philly, right? He's like, yeah, you know, I got my cousin, I saw my cousin Tony over the holidays. And he's like, oh, Tony, how's work? He goes, that's all right. He goes, what's the matter? He goes, what do you mean, what's the matter? He goes, well, how's work going? He goes, how do you think it's going? I paint ships down at the paint yard, at the boatyard. He goes, how's it going? He goes, how do you think it's going? I paint gray ships gray. I can't even stand back and admire my work. And it's like...
I know. My favorite one he always did was, hey, Dom, you think this is too big for my body? What, are you kidding me? You think my head's too big? A lot of my relatives I can't recognize from five blocks away. But you, every feature, crystal clear. Yeah, old Dom was great, man. Yeah. Dom is still one of the best comics around. So.
Oh, yeah. He's the best. He's the
best. Well, I started, that's the thing about when I started doing it on stage. Mm. That first time I did it on stage, it was funny. It even said Dan Whitney, a.k.a. Larry the Cable Guy.
So when you did that one popped more than anything else on stage, and you couldn't follow it at that point.
And like, I could not follow it. It was the first time I ever did it on stage. I'd never been seen out of the radio. So... People wanted to see this. Who did it? And the funny thing was, I'm signing autographs and I'm taking pictures. It was a whole new thing, you know. I mean, yeah. I was doing well. A lot of people always go, "Hey, he was a struggling comedian. He made up this." I was doing well in comedy clubs. I had a really fast-paced act, and it was awesome. I had a great act. But matter of fact, there's a lot of club owners that when I go and I'll work a theater, they'll come out or the arena, and they'll come out and they'll. We'll get to talk and go, man, I'll tell you what, I love this Larry the Cable Guy thing, but we sure missed that old Dan Whitney act. That was funny. You know, so it's not like I was just struggling, oh, what am I going to do, you know?
No.
I mean, I was doing fine. But, I mean, I wasn't a name. I wasn't, right. You know, I was
but you were, but you were building your act. And what
I was building my act. I wasn't selling tickets because I wasn't a nationally known or whatever act. But... Right. But it was funny. It said Dan Whitney, a.k.a. Larry the Cable Guy. And after it was over with, people were still going, "Hey, Larry, man, we sure enjoy you." Well, they know I'm not Larry. I was just up there with Dan Whitney. But they love the character so much. And so then that's when he said, "Look, you can't." Les said, "Look, you can't follow what you created." He goes, "You might as well go up with as the creation."
So maybe you've got a great idea for a business and want to start selling your products or services online. Maybe you're an established business owner looking for new customers, or maybe you're interested in starting a personal website. No matter who you are, GoDaddy wants to help you succeed online. Right now, GoDaddy is offering a .com domain for just, get this, $1.49. You know, you can't get $1.49 for $1.49. That's a bargain, people. It's go time. Start your website today. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter promo code Paul149. That's Paul149, all one word, to get your $1.49.com. Some limitations apply. See website for detail.
He said it's hilarious. People will love it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I started doing. I started promoting myself. I started, you know, I was getting more radio stations because at that point in time, comedy was saturated big time on radio television.
Yeah.
And pay was dropping and comedy clubs were closing and people were trying to figure out, there were comedians, well, what do I want to do? How do am I going to make a living? Because there's so many comedians and there's not as many places to work anymore. The money sucks. And I said to myself, hey, if I promote myself as Larry the Cable Guy, I love doing it. It's fun to write for it. It's fun to perform it. Plus, I can sell tickets. If I can get on a radio station and push it, I can sell tickets. And so that's what I did. Foxworthy taught me a long time ago, it's called show business for a reason. And if you're not good at the business end, the show end's going to suck. But if you're really good at the business end, the show part is going to come right along with it.
Yeah.
And that's why you see a lot of guys that are 100 times funnier than I will ever be still stuck in limbo, because they don't like to do the business part.
And I think what you're saying is the key thing that you figured out for the business for you, for Dan Whitney and then Larry the Cable Guy, was to use radio and these regular, and people need to understand, like, you would do, tell them the numbers, like you would do 2-3 radio stations a day.
Yeah, I had a schedule mapped out. My first radio station, of course, I ever had was 95YNF in Tampa. I left them. I left that station, and I picked up WDIZ in Orlando, 98 Rock in Baltimore, and The Edge in Tulsa. I got syndicated on all three of those stations, and from that point on, I would go around the country doing my act as Dan Whitney. They would ask me, what is this thing you're doing on Bitboard, this Larry the Cable Guy? And I told them what it was. I told them I would do it for them. I told them they did not have to pay me to do it. I never went for the pay. I always thought if I do this long enough, something's going to happen. And so they said, we don't got to pay you. And I said, no. Well, shoot, we'll do it then. I said, all I ask is that you promote me when I come to the comedy club. Just promote me. Mm-hmm. And that was my payoff. They would do the radio promotion. The comedy clubs liked it because they were getting basically free promotion from the radio stations.
And so how many times?
I ended up picking Omaha. I went all the way from upstate New York, Phoenix, Arizona, out to California, down into Texas. So at one point, I think the highest point that I had was about 27 radio stations that I called during the course of the week. The most I did in one day was 11 stations, and four out of those seven I did commentaries for 5 days a week, the other ones 3 days a week, some of them 1 day a week. So it went like that. So it was, I did that every day for 13 years.
Jesus. So you're writing constant. How are you generating all this material?
When we would finish a comedy club, and you can ask all the comics that I used to work with, they would all go to a club, or they go dancing, or they go somewhere. They go drinking. They do something. I'd probably go for maybe a half an hour, and I'd go back to the room. I'd watch the news. I'd here's how I would do the commentaries. I would watch the news, and I would, you know, you watch the news, you get frustrated.
Yeah.
And you go, well, and so I would write a commentary about whatever was the story of the day. And I'm a conservative guy. I make no bones about it. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm like a conservatarian, I guess. I'm a libertarian, conservative libertarian. I don't know if there's a name for it.
No, I know, but you're saying you're not super right wing, but you're in the conservative side of things. I get you.
Right. And so I would write these commentaries if I was writing an actual commentary for a paper. And I would make points, and I would make a good comment, but it was me. And then I would Larry it up, and I would put something in where people goes, man, I can't believe he would just say that. And stuff that I would never, ever, if I was in some kind of a political argument, I'm not going to argue it this way, because that's the stupid way to argue it, because it's a bonehead statement.
Right.
But Archie made bonehead statements.
Yeah. So just for example, just throw something out I see what you're saying. You'd write it straight, like it was a straight commentary that could end up in the back of the New York Times or whatever. But then you'd Larry it up with your comedy, some points.
Basically, I put some couple of fart jokes in and talk about if I was with Hillary Clinton, I don't get what. You know, and then you'd say something about, you know, her having a, you'd say something about her tits, or you'd say, you know, you would just put something completely ridiculous in there.
So you might be talking about her as Secretary of State, and then, like, in her policy regarding ISIS, but then do a joke about her tits or her big ass or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Something that has nothing to do with what you're talking about, because you're trying to do it for shocking effect and you're trying to be funny. For instance, I did a commentary on, North Korea. It was when Iraq, when the war broke out, way back the first one, in 94 with George Bush. Senior, what was that, 92?
Probably 91. Yeah.
91, 92.
Yep, I think 91.
as far back as that, I'm trying to think. But anyway, I was doing a commentary about Iran. No, it wasn't that. It was Iran. Iran was doing something. Ayatollah did something that pissed me off. And so he would say stuff like, look, I ain't got nothing against dadgum Iranians. God bless them. I hope they all get new carpets. I hope they get new flying carpets for Christmas. God bless them. You know, now obviously me as a individual am not going to talk like that in a normal conversation because it's moronic. Larry the Cable Guy doesn't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah. And that
he
is...
He doesn't have a problem with the Iranian people. God bless them. I hope they all get flying carpets for Christmas and brand new bottles full of genies.
That's your southern
watching TV, and his vision of Iran is genies in bottles and people flying carpets around.
right.
Because he doesn't know.
Right. Well, that's exactly the southern Archie Bunker is a perfect way of saying it. Like that's it. It's that Archie would say, "Yeah, I don't have a problem with the black people as long as they keep the grease from the chicken off of my shirt." Like, and he'd like.
And well, exactly. I mean, it was the same kind of thing. Now, obviously, in real life, no, I don't think that. I mean, that's stupid. Do you even think that? But that's what the character did. So, and so I did those early on in my commentaries. You know, I'm one of those acts that you either really, really like or you really despise.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons why people really, really despise if they don't like me is because of stuff like that. But they have no idea that that's not me.
Right. Did you have to come to terms with that, like, mentally? I mean, look, we're people pleasers by nature. You know, we want everybody to like us. We're, you know, the classics.
I like everybody. I never had problems with other comedians. I've always gotten along with everybody. It does. I don't let it bother me anymore, but it used to bother me. But where they always say, one of the things is the criticisms I always get is, well, he's always in character. He's become his character. He never, you never see him out of character. He never separates himself from his character. And I, what always flusters me about that is, well, neither does Stephen Colbert.
Yeah.
Every time you see Stephen Colbert, he's that character that he portrays. You don't know who the still real Stephen Colbert is.
Right.
Unless you read an article on the real Stephen Colbert. But every time you see him on TV, he's, you know, he's
Stephen Colbert. Good point. And I think you've even said that you're...
I'm out of character all the time. But, you know, I'm out in public, I'm out of character. People just call me Larry because they know me as Larry the Cable Guy.
No, I've hung out with you and you're totally out of character, except for the constant farting. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, that's a bell, bro. That's physical.
By the way, what are you wearing? Are you wearing, like, shorts? Are you sitting in one of your big comfy chairs in shorts?
No, I'm sitting at my desk, and I got regular clothes on. It's cold out, so I got one of these big, thick, Duluth Trading Company flannels on because it's about 20 degrees. I'm a completely normal guy. I think that's probably, you know, I separate myself all the time. And the people, every time I see me, always, well, you know what? That's because when I'm on TV, I'm hired to be Larry the Cable Guy.
Right.
I mean, I think I tried to let people know that when I did my show Only in America, I mean, I came out of character all the time.
Well, I think, you know, look, part of it is just, you know, visually, it's hard for you to come out of character because your character isn't that visually different from who you are, right? Really, like, the only difference
I think you're making a good point there, Paul. I think probably Stephen Colbert is doing what I do, except he is portraying someone completely opposite him.
Yes.
I am playing someone that is, I would say he's completely opposite me, but he's in the same political alignment, but I would not agree with what he says to get his point across.
And the other thing that I think
and there's a lot of people like that in real life. I mean, I hang out with a lot of people whenever a political argument starts, and I got a couple of buddies of mine that start in. I'm thinking to myself, oh boy, you know, you're really not winning any friends by trying to say it that way.
Right.
I mean, at least try to act like you have a little education when you say something.
Yeah, that you read something.
So I'm basically playing that small 1% of people that act that way. Is basically what I'm doing in my circle of friends. You say there's 50 people in my circle of friends. We all have the same political background. We all kind of go down the same political line. They're going to have two guys in there that agree with you, but say things completely stupid that don't help your cause.
Right, exactly.
I am portraying one of those two guys.
Well, the other thing that's really interesting that I read that you said is that over time, your character was 100%. Like, before you had a wife, you got two kids and blah, blah, blah. You know, you're like most comics starting out, a young guy, single. And Larry the Cable Guy was like just 100% of a character. But then over time, you've morphed your real life into Larry. So Larry will talk about his kids, right? And his kids are Dan Whitney's kids, but you're not saying Dan Whitney's kids, but you're taking your life experiences as Dan Whitney's and putting it through that prism of Larry the Cable Guy, right? So there's some...
And then as Larry the Cable Guy, I can embellish on those and make stuff up about those, but
yeah.
I still want to keep it Larry the Cable Guy. Now, I will say... Yeah, that's the crazy thing about my career, Paul. I never intended to do it on stage. It just happened. And the success started coming and coming. So you don't know. At the time, you didn't really, everything you did was, yeah, man, I don't give a shit. Call me whatever you want to call me. I'm making money, and I'm having a good time, and I'm single, and I'm in the tour bus. And but through time, I got married, and my wife is awesome. So obviously, you things happen, and you want to put things in your relationship into your act.
Yeah.
Then kids come along. And so that completely changes a lot of your act. So people like Larry the Cable Guy, people see me on stage as Larry the Cable Guy. I do Larry the Cable Guy on stage. And so I just started incorporating a lot of my life into Larry the Cable Guy because it gave me more relatable material to people that were growing with me and having the same experience of kids and a lot. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing with, like, a Dane Cook, like, who blew up with a certain generation of people, but then at some point your act has to evolve. As those people grow, you either have to keep your act what it is and hope you get that next young generation to come in and click with you, or you just have to keep – you have to grow with your audience and talk about things that are happening.
And that's what I did. I grew the character with me because my audience was growing with the character. I would feel really stupid with a wife and a couple of kids going, yeah, I was a teen boy last week, and we, you know. So, you know, and to me, it didn't seem right internally because so many people, we live in an age now where that's what people know me as. I mean, I have a real name. Most of them know my real name.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, when I worked at a radio station, everybody had that radio name. I still call everybody that I worked with on the radio by their radio name because I just know that as them.
Was there something when you were doing
people call me Larry because they see me as Larry, huh?
Right. And that's okay with you. You don't feel lost in being...
I don't care because, in my opinion, here's the deal. I'm a comedian.
Mm.
My job in life has been to make people laugh, and I love making people laugh. I love making people hopefully happy for a little bit in this ungrateful world that we live in, full of hate. Everybody's so full of freaking hate in this world.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I can get them to come to a comedy club and just kick back and set aside all of everything and just laugh at nonsense for an hour and 20 minutes, then that's fine. If people want to see me as Larry and call me Larry, hey, man, get her done. If that makes them happy, I could care less because when I get home, it's me and my wife and my kids, and I'm just like everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's what matters to me is my family. If people want to see me as Larry the Cable Guy, that's completely fine. I mean, as long as it makes them happy and it makes them laugh, no, I do not have a problem with it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You know, the other thing that I don't think people realize, and you actually alluded to this one time in a conversation about Chris Rock. You referenced Chris Rock and George Lopez, but like even with me, and I'm not doing a character, but in a way I am, and I think we all are on stage. I think what we do on stage, whether it's a full-on character, sort of like you're doing now, or what I do, or Chris Rock, or whatever. I'm not saying I'm Chris Rock, but it's an extension of us.
He's shorter than you.
He's shorter, and
you look just like him, but he's shorter.
He's a little darker. I don't know if he's Italian. I don't think he is. I'm a big fan. Don't get me wrong. But someone said to me after they saw me performing, they're like, are you, and I get worked up on stage, and you know, I'm Italian, I get animated, whatever, and like, are you like that? Well, not to that extent all the time. I don't think anybody would want to be around me, but that is kind of who I am on stage. I'm amping some stuff up because of, you know, I'm performing, and you mentioned that about Chris Rock and George Lopez, and your observation that I know Chris, and we hang out at the Comedy Cellar and talk, and he's much more subdued off stage and a little bit less street off stage, but then he gets on stage and he becomes like, you know, that thing,
well,
you know?
Exactly. I mean, that's another thing that was always, kind of bothered me. They would make fun of Foxworthy. They definitely made fun of me. He's not a real Southern. He doesn't have a real accent. He's putting that accent on. But you ever hear of, but you know what? So you just said his name. I'm so bad at names.
Lopez, Chris Rock,
George Lopez. Mm. You want to hang out with George Lopez off stage? He sounds like you and me. You know, and then the minute somebody drives by, hey, George, hello, it's the Ramos, get out, you know, get back. You know? I mean, it's all for effect. What about, and like, what's her name that talks like, who's the black girl that's, she's really funny. She's, she gave Leno an award at the Kennedy Center.
Oh, I don't remember.
So bad.
Oh, Wanda Sykes.
Wanda Sykes. She doesn't talk like that 24 hours a day.
I know.
For effect.
I know. She sounds like a southern maid from the 1800s. Like, what'd you say, Mr. Paul? What?
But they know, Chris Rock knows as well as you know, as well as I know. That embellishes the joke. It helps the joke. It helps sell the joke. It's all about delivery.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting to me because I never looked at it that way as the Archie Bunker thing, but that's exactly what it is. And you found a way to kind of say these things and have people kind of want to hear it from you, but it only could come out of you and work, like out of that character.
That's the thing. And I think the fact that it just latched onto the people so good is I really think that there's, that people in this country are just flat out sick and tired of being told they're this and they're told they're that by the news, and everybody is. I think people really like to go see somebody every now and then, or they like to be a fan of somebody that doesn't give a shit, that knows they live in a free country and they're allowed to say anything they want to say. And if you don't like their act, don't go see their act. But you know what? We like it. We think it's funny. It's funny. Comedians are different, though, than I think most people, because comedians have senses of humor that a lot of people don't have. We can laugh at a lot of things because, you know, we find a lot of comedy and tragedy because a lot of times that's how we deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so people, some people that can't understand that, then you can't understand that. But
it gets dark.
I'm going to tell you something. Comedy has got me through a lot of friends that have passed away, or a sudden car accident, or somebody's. You know what I mean? When it's a moment of sadness, a one-liner is the greatest form of therapy.
Oh, absolutely.
And for people that can't understand it, then I feel sorry for you. But
my sister-in-law just passed away a few weeks ago in a car accident, and they cremated her and they brought the ashes home, and everybody was out of the house, and I had to go just look at the box. So I was in the bedroom and I'm looking at the box, and I lifted the box up and I'm like, whoa, this is heavy. And then the box slipped out of my hand, and I'm like, oh, my God, I dropped Cindy. And I started laughing, right? I just blurted it out, right? And I told my brother-in-law that, her husband, and he was laughing his ass off. It's like I think that's sort of, I don't know if it's a defense mechanism or what it is. It's a way to cope. But I think that, and I agree with you, I go on these cable news shows, so I guess I'm guilty of being part of the problem, but I think these cable news shows have made the country very divisive in a way, like, because, you know, everybody on one channel wants to just put their view out, and another on that channel wants to put their view out, and everybody's just yelling at each other, and nobody's really having a dialogue.
You might be right, but you know what, you can't have one view, then you're not going to have other views.
Yeah.
So you have to have different views. So, yeah, definitely have to have different views. But, you know, like we were saying about how when you get older and you grow with your act, like, there's a lot of things that I would never, like, back in the day when I was single and I'm doing jokes and I could care, there's a lot of jokes probably that I did back in the day that I would never even think of doing today because I have two kids that are getting older, you know, when they're 7 and 8, you know. There's jokes that I probably wish I could have back, or there's stuff on tape I probably wish I could have back because now I have kids and I never realized if you had kids. You know what I mean? So the character Larry the Cable Guy that I do is definitely grown, and you know, you can't make everybody happy. I get things like this now. He's still funny, but he's not as edgy as he was. Because now I'm doing kids' movies. You know, I'm putting out these G-rated movies for kids. But I do that because I got kids.
And, yeah. And why not? Well, what was it about Steve Martin and Monty Python? And I think, what is it about that that really grabbed you in terms of influences comedically?
Just the nonsensical, weirdo humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Steve Martin with an arrow through his head doing Happy Feet when I was a kid, for some reason, made me laugh. I mean, why do farts make you laugh? Why does somebody popping out a fart and not meaning to in a public, why do you still laugh at the age of 45, at the age of 50? Why is that funny to you?
Yeah.
Because it's hilarious. You can't explain it,
right,
but it's funny. And I don't care if you're Kate Blanchett and you think you're the most sophisticated actress on the planet. If you're walking down the street and somebody walks by, you're going to crack a smile because it's, one, embarrassing, and two, it's a funny sound. So why did Steve Martin and Monty Python make me laugh? Because they did crazy things that just, you can't explain why they're funny. It's like those people that laugh and go, why am I laughing? This is so stupid.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. Funny you should say that, because I had Terry Gilliam on the podcast and we were talking about how their process of writing in Monty Python. And he goes, you know, we just get in a room and we'd get silly and we'd say, we start doing like literally silly, childish things like, committee of funny walks or whatever that, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah,
that,
exactly.
Because we were just goofing around one day. He said, I think we might have been smoking some weed or something, and one thing led to another. And he said it was like, you know, you're with your best friends in high school or college, and you just, there's those three or four guys that just make you piss your pants doing stupid stuff. And we just figured we'd write it and perform it. And it's sort of like, it's as simple as that. There's a purity to it, which you don't want to get ruined by people having too many opinions about it. Like, a fart is funny. Fuck it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like...
Right, exactly. Funny is funny. And I just think there's so many... Look, I've never been one of these guys. It's like, you do a certain kind of comedy, that's fine. God bless you. You found an audience. I'm all for it. But it's always irritated me. There's a certain type of comic in the country that if you're not doing it the way they're doing it, if you're not trying to make social change, then you're not a comedian.
Mm.
It's like bullshit. Mm. I mean, look at all these guys that came up before you, all the vaudeville guys. They were freaking hilarious. Your job is you're a comedian.
Mm. Mm. Well,
If you want to do comedy, make social change, fine. God bless you. Do it. But don't ridicule the other comedians that are just being comedians because they like being comedians. They like making people laugh.
Well, part of the problem with the comedy world is it's very cliquish. I mean, it is kind of high schoolish in a way, and it's sort of like, well, there's this set of people and there's this set of people, and I was always of the view there should be no rules. Like, people say to me, like, well, you do this kind of thing. I'm like, I just do what I think is funny and I'm passionate about. That really makes me laugh and that I want to talk about. And I don't know, whatever the audience thinks, but, you know, it's like, and you can make change in other ways. I mean, like, look, you've done amazing stuff. You give back a lot. You've donated a wing of a hospital in Florida because your son had hip dysplasia as an infant, and you want to help kids with hip dysplasia as an infant, and that's an amazing thing. It's named in your son's name, Wyatt, and you do a lot of stuff in the Nebraska area, and you did a show for 50,000 people and charged them like $4 a head at Memorial Stadium. I scalped a lot of tickets for $100 at that show, so I want to thank you very much for that. But
that was a crazy night, by the way. That was fun. But you know, when you get to a certain level and stuff, you want to give back and pay back the community, because they help. If it wasn't for people buying your tickets and helping you be successful, you wouldn't be there. So starting a foundation or giving back or doing something like that, that's what it's all about. That's the cool thing about it. And so it doesn't matter what kind of comedy you do. God bless you. Anybody that's doing stand-up in this country, I don't care what kind of stand-up you're doing, You know, it's like Lemmy from Motorhead said, you know, throw it against a wall and or fly it up the flagpole and see who salutes it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what was it like
that's,
for...
That's the perfect statement that Lemmy made, because they were asking him about other... They were asking him, I think in that statement, they were asking him about, you know, about the bands and what kind of bands he like. And he basically said the same thing, hey, whatever, you know, fly it up the flagpole, see who salutes it.
So I heard you had this, like, always had this, not maybe not so secret, but this desire to be, like, in a 70s hair band. And because you're, like, a guitar player, too. And you did air guitar at this huge show during your, like, after your stand-up. A bunch of guys came out and you did, like, air guitar in front of, like, 50,000 people at this big show. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, we did. It was awesome. It was me and Josh Wolf.
Mm.
Yeah, it was me, Josh Wolf, and my tour manager, and Randy, and my promoter, one of the guys from the promoters company. We went on stage. We did it when we were touring heavily, and we were doing a ton of arenas. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd put on wigs, and we'd go on stage. We'd play 12 heavy metal tunes from the 80s. Heavy on Striper. We were heavy on Striper.
Nice.
And it started because we took a trainer with us on the road, my buddy Dave, so we wouldn't get super obese. So we wanted to try to watch what we eat and at least exercise.
Right.
So he would make us exercise. And I went on stage one day and I said, Dave, man, because he always wanted us to run laps in the arena and it sucked. I was just trying to find ways to make it fun. I said, hey, Dave, get up here, grab that broom and get up here and air guitar a song with me and tell me this isn't the best freaking exercise you can do. Because I was sweat. I was dripping with sweat. So he air guitared a Def Leppard song with me and he goes, man, he goes, that's a great exercise. I mean, my heart's pounding. I mean, we didn't stop. I said, let's do that tomorrow. Let's do 12 songs, and instead of running the arena, let's do that. So I went down, and I told my guys, I said, hey, go to a pawn shop and buy a drum kit, two guitars, and a bass.
That's awesome.
We went to a pawn shop. We wanted to do a step up from air guitar. We wanted to do guitars that weren't plugged in.
All right, there
and
you
so
go.
So we went a step up, and that's what we did. And so the crew would set that up for us and put lighting on the stage, and at 3 o'clock, we'd play for about an hour and 20 minutes. Or an hour or something like that, and we were just dripping with sweat. We were freaking out, dude. We taped it. We made a little documentary. And then to cap it off, I did that show at Memorial Stadium for 53,000 people. Yeah. And at the end of the night, me and Josh, we came out, and he sang Journey, and I played guitar, and Randy was on drums, and we had the bass player, and then I switched to the singing, and we sang Whitesnake.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Dude, it was the greatest thing on the planet. The funniest moment there was Josh Wolf came up to me and Damien, who's playing bass, and Josh goes, and as he's saying this, there's a roadie pushing some lights on wheels right in front of us. Mm-hmm. And as he says this, he goes, Dan, this was the coolest thing I've ever done. Nobody does this. Nobody gets to do this. And as soon as he said that, the roadie goes, huh, shit, Journey never even did that. It was 53,000 people. So, I mean, it's something stupid, but it's fun to do. We sure enjoyed it.
Do you make any adjustments in your performance? Just before we wrap up, I'm curious, like, just technically, when you're playing for, you know, you went from 300 people to 1,000 people to 5,000 people to 53,000 people. Do you make any adjustments in your performance? And did it like in a stadium like that?
Yeah, you know, when I do stadium, you know, so I'm one liner, so it's all about the timing.
Yeah.
So I slow it down a little bit. I don't try to talk as fast. But when I work I work the stadium the same way I work the arena. Mm. I literally played for all the people sitting around the stage. And yeah. I just figured everybody else can follow in behind them because you can't play to everybody. You're around. But I just kind of blot it out. I kind of block out everybody else and I perform for who I can see right in front of me.
Yeah.
And everybody else just kind of comes along for the ride. I think that kind of helps it out. But you just have to do a few of them to prepare. Before I started doing arenas, I was doing some theaters to do it first, and so I did some theaters. But to get ready for the arenas, Travis Tritt took me out with him to open for him for about 15 dates so I could get a feel of it.
Yeah.
And so I got a feel of it pretty good after the first, you know,
that's great.
9 or 10 of them, so I was ready for it after that. But the stadium thing, you know, that was a whole different deal. I'll never do that again. I don't even want to attempt to do that again. It's
why?
Nerve-wracking.
Stressful?
And it makes you
Were you nervous?
I was nervous. Not only was I performing for that many people, but we were filming it for a Comedy Central special.
Oh, Jesus.
And my manager just so happened at the time decided he wanted to do it at a time when I was on vacation. So I had not been on stage in 6 weeks.
Oh, Jesus.
And so I had to go do one of the biggest shows of my life and not be. So I went up to Omaha Funny Bone and I did 4 shows to get ready for it. And so, yeah, it was a nerve-wracking. My jaw started popping. I went to the dentist. I thought he put a filling in wrong or
something. Jesus Christ.
And he said, "Are you stressing out? Because that's from stress." I go, "Are you kidding me?" And sure enough, that thing popped for about 3 weeks. And the minute I walked off stage, the popping went away. That's so bizarre.
Well, good for you, man. Listen, we got to do another one of these. I could talk to you forever.
Paul, I could talk to you forever, too. You and I, we just go way back.
I didn't get to see you this month because I had to cancel my trip to the Omaha Funny Bone because of that accident in the family. But when I come back, maybe I'll see you when you come to New York. We'll text or talk.
Yeah, definitely sounds good. You're always welcome to the house when you come down here, man. We had a good time that one time.
I had a great time, and wife's adorable, and the kids, and you guys are so nice to me. And I took a couple of your belongings, but I sold them on eBay, and I got a lot of money for them. I really appreciate it very much.
I'm surprised.
No, it was good, man. Your underwear goes for a lot, even with the holes in it. It's a pretty impressive thing, I'll tell you. It's Larry the Cable Guy underwear that goes for a lot.
Crotchless britches are hard to find. They're pretty sexy.
You are a sexy, sexy man.
That was one of my all-time favorite jokes I ever did was the crotchless with the Victoria's Secret, and they have britches in there with no crotch in them. They sell them some bitches for $25. You believe that? Good Lord, I got a whole drawer full of them at the house. I bet I'm sitting on $2,000-$3,000 worth of them britches.
Hey, what up? Jingle All the Way 2 is coming out, right?
Yeah, Jingle All the Way too, man. It's it's a cool movie. Fox Home Video. We've been doing some kids movies together. They're a lot of fun. My little boy's in this movie. Oh. I put him in as a homeless kid. So he's at the homeless shelter getting a present with his mom. So it's pretty cool. My kids, the kids love it. I'm getting good feedback on it already from some people that got kids. So
it's
T-rated. So I hope people enjoy it. It's a fun movie.
I want to see Larry the Cable Guy in an X-rated movie. Let's make that happen. You can go to town there, man.
You know what? Back in the day, I might have thought about it.
Put you on a pole, man. You'll be like the next Magic Mike.
Trust me, you're not going to want to see me naked right now.
The way you just said that, I want to see you naked right now.
You know when you can use the back of your neck as a travel pillow, you need to stop. Paul, I'm not kidding. This is a true story. I actually, 2 days ago, I had to show my tits to get out of a ticket. Okay. But the good news is I got invited to the policeman's ball.
There you go. You are... There's always an upside being you. Hey, you're the best, man. Thanks for being on. Larry the Cable Guy, all over the place. So you got tour dates coming up you want people to know about?
You know what? All I got left for the rest of the year is I got Las Vegas with Foxworthy coming up. We're doing something together in Vegas on the 12th and 13th, I think. Other than that,
You're just home growing mantis. All right, that sounds good.
Exactly right.
All right, brother.
Wait till the end of the year so I can stop growing them and get back on a diet. Holy shit! They wanted me to come down. They called me at Fort Bragg. Said you want to come down? And I said yes. So I thought I was going down to perform for the troops. They just wanted me to show up and show them all what they used to look like before they went to boot camp.
You're the before. Men, you do not want to be this man. And then you show up in your Prilosec cutout, right?
Exactly.
All right. All right, man, you're the best. I'll talk
to you. Good luck on all this stuff, man. These things are good. That's what I'm talking about, show business, man. You're one of the guys that's out there busting ass and doing the right things.
I'm trying, man. I'm going back on Fox News when I get back to New York next week.
Dude, you're doing the right things, I'm telling you. I love you.
Well, you know, it's funny.
You do great on Fox, man, even though I only half agree with half of you.
I half the time I'm with you. Sometimes I go the other way. But, it's funny. I'm looking for my Larry the Cable Guy moment where I start really busting out much bigger. I mean, things are going great, and I'm working in great rooms like the Columbus Funny Bone and selling tickets and everything.
No doubt. You're doing exactly the right things.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. You know, like you've done and Lewis Black has done and Brian Regan, you know, guys that I really look up to, like, you know, how do I...
Let me tell you this right now, because I see you all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you already have more popularity than 98.9% of every comedian out there, so...
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Well, tell my wife so I can get laid, will you? Jesus Christ, I'm dying.
All right, I'll do my best.
All right, buddy. Say hi to the wife.
I don't have a problem with her. I don't know where you are.
What? Come on. All right, I'll see you later, man. Be good.
Hey, love you, Paul. Thanks.
Love you. Take care. Have a good holiday, buddy.
Hey, buddy. You too.
All right, so that was Dan Whitney, a.k.a. Larry the Cable Guy. So funny and really interesting approach. That Archie Bunker analogy, I think, is really apt and really sort of an interesting way of looking at it. That's essentially what he created, and it wasn't without a lot of hard work and thought, and I think, you know, a lot of credit to him for coming up with something that's really resonated with a lot of people. And keep following me on Facebook and Twitter, Paul Mercurio, and also follow me all over the country. You can see my tour dates on my website, paulmercurio.com, as well as my Facebook page, Paul Mercurio. All right, see you next week.